How have you not seen this?
Welcome back to How Have You Not Seen This. As always, it's me, your host, Dustin Meadows. Today, I'm joined by returner to the show, favorite guest, Matt Monta.
Wow, favorite.
Well, one of them. And we just watched From Dusk Till Dawn, which is stretching the rules a little bit for the month of Tarantino. The screenplay is written by Tarantino, but actually directed by Robert Rodriguez. The pair have been fairly frequent collaborators over the years. Working on some of the same projects like Four Rooms, as well as contributing to each other's projects like Kill Bill Volume 2, Sin City, so forth and so on. And of course, Death Proof, their team up double feature where they each directed their own feature length film and released it as a double feature. From Dusk Till Dawn, starring George Clooney, before he had really blown up, like he was doing ER and everything. So this was the time to get George Clooney in a movie like this. And it starts off as pretty typical kind of heist crime movie, and then, oh, hey, there's vampires in it. So, Matt, how have you not seen this?
I didn't even know this movie existed. Until you're like, hey, do you want to come over and watch this movie? I had no idea this movie even existed.
Oh, man.
That's how I haven't seen it.
That makes sense. It's unfortunate this movie has slipped under the radar for some people. Especially now that we've talked about this while we're watching the movie. It's spawned two sequels, but neither of which are very good. The second one stars Robert Patrick, a.k.a. the T-1000, and the third one stars the guy who played Jango Fett in the Star Wars prequels. it's a great movie. It's one of my favorite movies. I remember seeing it in high school, and especially then, like, it was, like, pre, like, this supernatural, like, resurgence that we saw in movies, so like there weren't a lot of horror / action type movies being made at that point. So it was nice when this came out, and I remember seeing the trailer for it, and then sitting down and starting the movie, I was like, alright, I've seen the titles and everything. I know that this is the same movie that I saw the trailer for because George Clooney is in it, but how do they get to a point where vampires come into the movie?
You know, I as we're sitting here talking, I'm wondering one thing. Do you think if they did a reboot of this with all the same characters, do you think it would be wildly successful because of all the like hot vampire stuff that's come out in the last several years?
It's hard to say. It's possible because there's definitely been a resurgence like the supernatural, like young adult fiction stuff. For example, it's like obviously the Twilight movies cleaned up at the box office. But then a movie like Beautiful Creatures came out, which was all about like witches and everything, and was abysmal and terrible, and that fucking ate shit at the box office.
Yeah.
So like, hey, I definitely, maybe if you cast like a Robert Pattinson in the George Clooney role,
yeah,
maybe it would be successful. But and that's the thing too, is like most movies now, or even like Warm Bodies, that movie. The take on supernatural fiction and film lately seems to be, instead of using the monsters as something to like kind of reflect a fear or to just, you know, be monsters, those movies are all about, oh, hey, let's fuck zombies now.
Yeah, zombies are just misunderstood.
Yeah.
And they need love, too.
Well, that's...
Even zombies need love.
And it's frustrating, like, I'm very much for innovation within a genre, but at the same time, like, like horror, the genre literally exists to offer some kind of commentary on like on fear, like the things that frighten us in real life, and to use something as some kind of an allegory for it.
Sure.
Like case in point, like I think like the Final Destination movies and even the first Nightmare on Elm Street, those movies are just about like the fear of like the uncertainty of like progressing through life as a teenager and like transitioning into adulthood. And kind of just the terror that comes with being dropped out of a comfortable area into, like, a real-world situation, especially when you're not ready for it.
Yeah.
And then, like, Twilight and Warm Bodies is just like, oh, this thing is a monster, but I want to fuck it.
Right. Well, you know, maybe, I don't know how that would play into fears. I mean, fucking vampires.
That yeah, yeah. Well, and that's part of why I can't get on board with that stuff. It's like I don't think it offers anything. Well, in Twilight, on top of it, Twilight is a very heavy-handed save yourself until marriage thing.
Right.
And then in the last installment, it becomes a very heavy-handed pro-life metaphor.
You mean for keeping the half-vampire baby?
Yeah, even at the risk of the mother's life.
Yeah.
And, like, it's just, it's like, fuck you, Mormons, don't write about vampires.
You know, I didn't get any of those religious overtones with this movie.
So. No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and that's because this movie was made very much with the intention of being, like, a legit horror slash action movie.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up sort of trying to tie in or expand upon what is the traditional genre. I mean, with this movie, it was like the vampires are what vampires are supposed to be.
Yeah.
You stab them through the heart, you set them on fire, you put holy water on them, you know, they touch sunlight, they explode. So, like, that remained the same, but what they did for this is they kind of changed the setting of it. And I think that's what a lot of horror movies do, but with what you're talking about with expanding the genre, there's one I saw, and I forget the name of it. I saw it in the theater when I was in college, and it was like the vampires had taken over, like, the legislature.
Oh,
because they became the majority population. So they began enacting policies, and this was like in 2004, 2005.
Is that with Ethan Hawke in that?
I think it was
Daybreakers.
That's what it was.
Yeah, because like the vampires control the world, and now like they coexist with humans, and they have like blood banks and blood farms set up essentially.
Right. And
they
make policies based on the vampire because like the humans can't get a majority to So it's like this whole, I guess, a oppression of, you know, but from these monsters, not by their strength or terror, but by their political savvy.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting take on that. Like, I think that's a good way to kind of turn the genre around and approach it at a fresh angle.
And I was disappointed. I thought they could have explored that a little more, because eventually it just became like stabbing vampires in the heart.
It kind of fell into the usual stuff.
Yeah, which is a little bit disappointing.
But yeah, and I remember seeing that movie, and like I think the movie was like, this is an okay movie.
Yeah.
Willem Dafoe was great, and I love Willem Dafoe in that movie. But like, the concept was great.
Sure.
Like, it was a really interesting idea for a vampire movie. It just kind of fell apart in the execution of it, but I still commend it for coming at it with a different take.
When I watch these horror movies that are from a different angle, I always find myself being disappointed, like, in the third act. It's like,
you
build up a lot of the psychological tension, and then it's just like, oh, it's a guy, you know, in a mask, or it's, you know, it's, oh, they were just, regular vampires all along.
Yeah.
And killed them with crosses and stuff. What I liked about this movie is there were really no bones about what was supposed to happen. There's no, you know, there's no romantic interest.
Yeah,
there's no political savvy. It's just human beings versus vampires.
Yeah, it's just a straight up fight for survival.
And that's what I think made this movie really enjoyable to watch for me, as far as like a horror movie. And a lot of it was tongue in cheek, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere who watched Commando, and there weren't a lot of like those one liner type of things, but it was very much, there was some subtle humor to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I really enjoyed. And you know, you brought up something. What you brought up in the intro was, I forgot about the vampires.
Yeah.
We were watching this, and it was a very convincing opening to take you in the direction of, like I said, like a heist movie.
Yeah.
Or that they were going to go and get into some kind of trouble, or it was going to be this relationship forming between the father and George Clooney. And then all of a sudden it's like Salma Hayek comes out, does this super sexy dance, and all of a sudden like everyone turns into vampires.
Yeah.
And for me, that was, I was turned off a little bit by that at first.
Yeah, it's definitely a jarring transition. Like, there's no hints at, like, about any of that. Like, you don't really have any unless you've watched the trailer for this movie,
right,
or read on it, you have no reason to think that what happens is going to happen at all.
Right. Well, it seemed kind of hokey. Like, it was like, oh, they're, like, wearing rubber masks.
Yeah.
And it was very much a comic book, I guess, style of emergence of, or introduction of these creatures.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as we watched and it went on, and my mind transitioned from, okay, this is like sort of a heist movie where Quentin Tarantino's a psychotic, like, murderous rapist.
Yeah.
To, oh, they're going to be blowing vampires' brains out. I realized that that comical aspect of it was necessary to suspend belief.
Yeah, certainly.
Because up to that point, everything was very realistic. And the only way to, I think, make a very convincing vampire action movie for the second half of it was to do something so ridiculous that you're like, what the hell is this? This is stupid.
Yeah.
But then it's good. It's good filmmaking. So once you get past that, you get pulled into this whole other story.
Yeah, and Tarantino and Rodriguez both are very good at doing that.
Yeah.
Like with Rodriguez, you look at like Machete, which is a completely over-the-top ridiculous movie, but because it's also a very funny movie, you're never like, oh, this is dumb, when he pulls out a guy's intestines and then uses it to rappel down the side of a building.
Yeah.
You're just like, no, this is what the movie has been building me up for. This makes sense. And then, yeah, and Tarantino the same way. Like, the way he writes dialogue in, like, a Pulp Fiction or something, like, you're shocked when he accidentally shoots a guy in the face when they're just talking in the car. But then you're like, no, this fits. This makes complete sense.
Right. And then later they get insulted for their, what was it, the choice of coffee or something. And Tarantino's like, I bought a coffee because when I send Nancy to the store, she buys shit.
Yeah.
I want to taste it.
And just stuff like that. Yeah, I get the gourmet shit. One of the other things I love, and we've talked about this in every episode that we've done for Tarantino, is how good the opening scenes of the movies are. And again, like, technically this is Rodriguez's film, Tarantino wrote, that first scene in the liquor store is really fucking good.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, it's it builds the tension perfectly, and then, like, you watch it, you're just like, oh, I wonder what's going on here. And then, again, like, it's kind of a surprise, like, when you see that pan, and, like, oh, George Clooney has a gun to a girl's head. Like,
yeah.
And there's that reveal, and then you find out what's going on, and, like, you're just drawn in.
Right. And the thing that Tarantino does really well, and I think a lot of, especially amateur filmmakers and screenwriters, miss, is that you need to establish your characters within the first few seconds of them appearing on screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this does that brilliantly. I mean, as soon as the ranger goes into the bathroom and Tarantino and Clooney come out with those girls with guns to their heads, like, you're like, oh, these guys are really bad guys.
Yeah.
And the way they talk and everything, it really defines their character.
Yeah.
Instead of having to do like a writer's hand thing, I'm like, well, these two brothers, you know, grew up, which they kind of give a little backstory later through a sort of satirical news piece, but
yeah.
You know, just the pacing of it and the dialogue and their mannerisms especially. I think Tarantino's very good at you know, like, mannerisms of secondary characters during conversation. So, you know, I was occasionally watching him while Clooney was doing a lot of the talking and noticing how he was reacting to the situation, which was very much in character.
Yeah, definitely.
For his role.
Well, I love it too, because, like, in that first scene, like, you get the tone for Clooney's character,
mm-hmm.
who is just always very in control of the situation.
Sure.
Like, and it, to the point, like, he insists on being in control of the situation, like, and being on top of it. And then, like, the first time Tarantino says anything, he whispers it, and, like, you don't hear anything, and that very much also establishes his character and how he conducts himself, even though you don't hear him speak until right after he shoots the ranger,
right.
The second time that they come out.
Yeah.
So I think that it's very interesting that he just is whispering his first lines of dialogue, and you just hear like you don't really know what he's saying, like, Clooney has to repeat it.
That's the brother dynamic between the two of them was fascinating.
Yeah.
It was not very, there wasn't a lot of screen time to explore it.
Yeah.
But the time that was on screen was incredibly valuable and very deep because, like you said, George Clooney was always, even when he wasn't in control of the situation, he insisted that
he was vying for it.
And, you know, his brother was like this psychopathic guy who just seemed to ruin everything, just make a mess of everything. But and Clooney very much at any time could have abandoned him, or shot him, or killed him, or done something. But instead, he felt it seemed like he felt his character felt compelled.
Yeah, like responsible for
it. Yeah, compelled to take care. It was almost like a Mice and Men kind of thing.
Instead of a rabbit getting murdered,
a mouse, it was like Bank Teller and all these other people.
Yeah, well, because after the scene where Tarantino was raped and killed their hostage, Clint Eastwood, he's clearly so fucking angry about it, and he's lecturing him. And then it ultimately just ends when everyone's like, fuck it, we're going to get out of here, we're going to get a better life, and none of this is going to matter. Because, he is looking out for his brother in spite of every single flaw he has, which is several.
Yeah.
To the point where, he almost blows their cover when they're crossing the border, because he decides to get sensitive about a comment that Clooney offhandedly makes about him acting like a fucking nut.
Right. It was interesting, because I kind of wish that they didn't do the vampire thing and they went with the direction they were going.
Because
that dynamic was very... I mean, there's a lot to talk about with how they were portrayed and Clooney's, explaining himself to his brother, saying, I don't kill people. He's like, I'm a thief. I'm not a psychopathic murderer. I don't kill people unless I have to. And I forget some of the other, kind of personal...
Yeah, it was a lot of that, general stuff, yeah.
But that's true. He would punch people and hit them, but he would never kill anybody unless he had to. And even with his brother, he gave a, not just a physical danger, but, couldn't give you peace in this life.
Yeah.
In that sense felt that he had to kill his brother.
Yeah. And he stops Tom Savini's character, Sex Machine, from doing it.
Yeah. So he that was kind of a line that stuck out to me where he said, I don't kill people unless I have to.
Yeah, and the only time they kill John Hawks' character at the liquor store in the very beginning, but that's not until John Hawks unloads a .45 on them.
Right.
So that's strictly an out of self defense thing. And that's insane too, because I love that entire scene, like I said, it's great. If John Hawks had just stayed behind the counter, he would have been fine. But instead, he opens a safe and draws out a hand cannon and just unloads on. I was like, how did you think this was going to end? With you returning fire?
Yeah. What was really fascinating to me is what were they doing there in the first place? He said, just go and buy a map.
That's what it was. He sent his brother Richie, Tarantino's character, in to buy a road map and then leave. That was the only reason they went in there. And then Tarantino took hostages because he was just a nut and thought that something was going on.
Right. I like the part when they came out and he's like, remember, I said, all I told you to do is just go in there and buy a map. Remember what I said about staying low? He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. He's like, that means not taking hostages, not shooting rangers, not setting gas stations on fire. And he's lecturing him. Wow, the whole gas station is exploding behind
them. Such a great shot.
And they're not even flinching.
Yeah, not fazed by it at all. That's one of my favorite shots in the entire movie. It's just the aftermath of that entire first scene.
So can we, and as we're sort of talking this out, when they did that news broadcast where they then displayed the kill counts as if it were the score from the football game.
Yeah.
Can we attribute 90% of those to his brother just randomly murdering
people? I feel like the majority of that had to be, and especially the civilian that they mentioned, who was run over in their escape. I feel like if Tarantino broke Clooney out, Tarantino had to have been the wheelman.
Yeah.
So again, I feel like that's another death that was probably on him.
Yeah, I would say that. Tarantino's character was so despicable. I was kind of glad he got killed. But what I liked is how they portrayed his psychosis. And it was just he fantasized that girl turning around to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Clooney's like, hey, go get the car. And he's just standing there and everyone's standing there the way it was before. And it was, what'd she say? Will you eat my pussy? And it was so offensive. It was like the most offensive thing. And then it was like never ever said or meant. I mean, it was sort of brought up again.
Yeah, just him visualizing it and then him and her clearly like just further driving the point. I was like, no, he imagined that because he's fucking psychotic.
And then, but then it was you, the audience, and Tarantino's character who were the only ones who were privy to that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So everyone else is just like, has no idea
that
what
are you talking about? What did I say in the hotel room? Yeah. So one of the other things I want to hit on, too. Cheech Marin, in this movie, cast in three different roles.
Was he? I thought that was Tommy Chong who was up front. I wasn't sure.
No,
Cheech was... I recognized him at the end.
No, that was Cheech for all three roles. Okay. So he was the Border Patrol officer.
Right.
He was the doorman at the Titty Twister, whose character is named Chet Pussy. That is
the character's name
in the credits in the script, yep. And then he was Carlos, the guy that Clooney and Tarantino were meeting in the morning at the very end of the movie.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting that he was just cast as three different characters.
Why do you suppose they did that?
Probably, I feel like Rodriguez probably did just the... probably keep costs down on it or something, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And just, it's also really funny to see Cheech cast in three different roles.
Well, he does them all great.
Oh, yeah, he knocks them out of the park.
Yeah.
Like, him standing out front barking at the Titty Twister is, like, just one of the funniest parts of the movie, too.
That's a monologue to memorize, I think.
Oh, yeah. You got apple pie, pussy.
If you can find pussy cheaper, fuck it.
Yeah, it's so good.
Do you think Cheech wrote that, or is that a Tarantino thing?
I think that was probably a Tarantino thing.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised if he let Cheech kind of ad-lib a little bit with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wouldn't surprise me to find out that the apple pie pussy line was an improvised line.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was... It was just... It was so over the top. I liked the when they came up on the Titty Twister, it reminded me of the whorehouse in Beetlejuice.
Oh yeah,
remember when he's like, "Hey ladies," and then he comes up to the little model and it's like, "I don't remember you building that."
Yeah,
that's kind of what it was. It was like this sort of cartoonish, biker bar, which turned out to be, spoiler alert, on top of some sort of Aztec temple.
Yep. And that's one of the sequels is actually a prequel that kind of delves into that. But at the same time, it's also wholly unnecessary.
Is it like the construction of the Titty Twister?
No, it's the third
like
one...
We have to get this zoned properly.
The third one is called The Hangman's Daughter,
okay.
And it's a Western.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the exact plot details of it, but essentially it ends with them like discovering this temple, and that's where they run into vampires.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the characters is actually... It's not played by Salma Hayek, but it's her character, Santanica Pandemonium.
Yeah.
Who is like... They're very silly sequels. And Danny Trejo is actually in the second one.
Really?
As a different character.
Okay.
So it's... Yeah, it's very weird that those exist at all. And I have yet to watch the TV series. Like, I'm going to check it out just because I'm curious. But they're... Like, every time they're like, oh, let's make a TV series out of this movie, it's like, no, like, you don't need to. Like, what could you possibly get out of this?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what insight. Like, same, they did it with Fargo, too, which, like,
mm-hmm.
which I've actually heard is really good. But at the same time, like, who said that a Coen Brothers movie from almost 20 years ago was a good idea to option into a television series?
Yeah.
Like, I'm curious how the pitch process, like, on some of these works... And what the selection process is for a network to say, yeah, this movie from 20 years ago would make a great TV show.
Like, what's eating Gilbert Grape?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what other questions could there possibly be? Like, how many times did Arnie's character sit in the bathtub and almost freeze to death alone? Like, it's weird to, like, to see all these years later them going back to the well. On From Dusk Till Dawn.
Do you think that they'll make a Big Lebowski television show?
God, I hope not. I love Big Lebowski.
Me too.
Big Lebowski way too much for it to.
I'd like to explore, not necessarily now, but maybe sometime on my own. Maybe this afternoon when I'm mowing the lawn or something. What it would be like if they just took a bunch of old 90s movies
yeah.
that were kind of cult classics and probably pretty popular for the day, but still hold up. And then them try to make like a series
yeah.
with like Zac Efron.
There's
like
Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, the show.
They did have
they
one.
They had the cartoon,
they had
yeah.
the cartoon, and Beetlejuice was a cartoon, which didn't quite make sense.
But, well, those came out at least within 2 years of the movies, though.
Right.
So that I at least understood that then. But for us today to sit here and say, like, Turner and Hooch, why isn't that a TV show right now?
Yeah. Kindergarten Cop.
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger, I don't think he's doing most these days, is he?
Nah, just being in an Expendables movie and then one disappointing action movie a year right now.
Yeah, well, you know, he's got to pay his bills and his alimony and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's very true.
Divorce lawyers and stuff.
Some of the other things we want to talk about, the casting in this movie is really good. Obviously, this might be my favorite George Clooney movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that full well knowing he's been in great Oscar-worthy movies or whatever. I don't give a shit. He has never played a character that I am as interested in as Seth Gecko in this movie.
Okay.
And I think it's just because he's so very obviously like cast against type, because this was
yeah.
right around ER, so like he was clean-cut, he mm-hmm. was handsome. So for him to play a role like this is a complete change of pace, and he knocks it out of the park.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Harvey Keitel, wonderful as Jacob.
Mm.
And then, why am I blanking? Oh, in the very small roles, Tom Savini, who came up as like a special effects artist, like working on a lot of the Romero Living Dead films. And then Fred Williamson as the character whose name I can't remember that does the Vietnam monologue.
And then Mime afterwards.
Yeah,
yeah. Imagining killing all the
people. Yeah, yeah. And then rips out a dude's heart.
Which was then stabbed with a pencil.
Yes,
like
yes,
sex machine.
Yeah. Sex machine!
Like you said, I've never seen this movie. And so I IMDb'd it, but didn't go too much in depth. But I saw, you know, Clooney was in it. And I'm a big George Clooney fan. I like George
yeah, he's
Clooney,
great.
Right? I think with George Clooney, you kind of get the same guy. And the film is sort of built around him. He's charming as hell in this movie.
Yeah.
Just as he is in every other movie he's in. But I think you get to see a little more of his chops as he explores sort of a darker,
yeah, absolutely.
More aggressive side with this character. Personally, I loved him in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, yeah, he's great. Like, when he's in Coen Brothers movies, he's phenomenal,
yeah.
too.
So for me, that's sort of my favorite George Clooney, which isn't to say he wasn't excellent in this, but what was that other one? He played like a secret agent.
Oh, Burn After Reading.
No. It was the one about like Syria. He was like an FBI agent.
Syriana?
Yeah, that one was okay.
I haven't seen that one.
It was. I think I ended up falling asleep near the end of it. But there was a scene where he got tortured, and that was he did a pretty good job with that. He was a good actor, but the movie was just long and boring.
Yeah,
you know. He wasn't nearly as charming as he is in these other ones.
He didn't
have a lot of sarcasm.
Yeah.
Tarantino was creepy as always. I think he's always for me is gonna be.
Oh yeah. Well, especially when he pops up in his own movies, you're just like, oh, yeah. Like you get like just like a chill. And you're like, oh, what a sleazeball.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it doesn't help, but like he almost always writes himself as those characters when he's in his movies too.
Yeah.
So.
I too liked Harvey Keitel.
Keitel is great.
I like him. I'm not too familiar with his body of work, but when he's in movies, I think he does an excellent job.
Oh yeah,
I thought he did a really good job in this movie too.
Yeah, he's great in this. Reservoir Dogs.
He was in Pulp Fiction too.
As the wolf.
Right?
Yeah,
he was great with that.
Oh yeah, he's got. Probably the least amount of screen time of any of the major characters in that movie, and he uses every second, like he wrings everything he can out of the screen time.
Oh, I remember almost all of his lines.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. Well, and he doesn't have very many too. Like he doesn't have a lot of dialogue, which is also interesting. A lot of it is just like kind of just watching him, like his mannerisms and everything. So yeah, it's really interesting.
With that role in Pulp Fiction, whenever I'm doing stuff with my car, or like my headlight burned out recently,
yeah.
and I remember that line where it's like,
He's like, everything in this car work? He's like, yeah, as long as we know. He's like, don't tell me I'm going to go down the street and I'm going to get pulled over for a taillight going
out.
And so I always remember that line in my head as I'm like trying to fix shit on my car.
Motherfucker's tip top.
Yeah.
Also, the thing with Clooney's character too, we've talked about this for most of the other movies we've done for Tarantino this month. Tarantino is clearly adopted the same thing that Hitchcock did, where he had these very charming villains. Because by the end of the movie, we remember that George Clooney is a murderer and a robber and a thief and a criminal.
Yeah.
But you're just like, man, I hope Clooney gets out of this okay. Like, you're siding with him. And it's the same thing with it, like with Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Bastards and DiCaprio and Django. Like, you almost forget that they're villains, and you're kind of like, oh man, I hope things were there. Like, no, they're the bad guy.
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to be on their side. They tricked me. They're so goddamn charismatic.
The only thing that can make his character seem good is the most evil in the world consolidated in one.
Yeah, like that's literally what it takes. Like vampires, like the damned have to attack him, and you're like, oh, okay, he's a good guy now. This is the one scenario in the world where Clooney's character is the hero.
Right. Well, the thing was is despite him, he does have his good qualities. He's a he's a loyal person. I mean, he could have very much just like bailed on all of them or not let Jacob back into the room. Or just, you know, whatever. But I think he also had a sense of vengeance and things like that.
Yeah. He's a thief, but he lives by a code.
Right, yeah. And that's what he said in the beginning of the movie. He's like, there are rules when doing these things. You can't just kill people, and it's 30%.
Yeah.
Which he then does negotiate down to 25% because of the death of his brother. That's like getting 10% off because you got a smoking room or something.
Yeah.
I forget what I was gonna say. I lost track of my thought.
Oh, that's all right. the action sequences in this movie are done very well. Like it's paced very well too, because up until the vampires come out, like that's a good 45 to 50 minutes of movie that we get.
Yeah.
Of like the Gecko brothers, like at the scene in the beginning, and then going to the motel, and then taking Jacob and his family, and then sitting in the Titty Twister drinking up until the dance number, and then they kill Cheech and Danny Trejo and the gorilla dude.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, hey, vampires for the last 45 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
The second stretch, because like, I like that the back half of the movie is split up essentially into two parts, where like obviously the first time when the vampires attack, and then to the point where they retreat to that back room and kind of like arm up for the final battle.
Yeah.
And like, and that final battle is maybe 12 minutes long. Like, or like from the second they step out of that room to the second they escape outside with the help of Cheech's character Carlos.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very tight. Like they could have spent a lot more time on it than they did, but they're really on point with all of it.
It was. I don't think anything was longer than it needed to be or too short.
Yeah,
I think everything felt as if it was timed the way it needed to be timed.
Yeah.
Like in Mission Impossible 2 or 3, there was like a chase scene that was probably like longer than the first half of this movie. And I'm like, okay, they're not going to catch him on the motorcycles. They're not going to catch him on the hang glider or whatever. They're not going to catch him on the boat.
Yeah.
Like just blow something up and stop wasting my time.
I want to say those probably two. Two is the only one of those that I'm not super crazy about. I love the rest of them.
But the thing about that kind of disappointed me with the end was that they didn't fashion enough gadgets.
Yeah.
Like I feel as though they, you know, with all the weird stuff they found in there, they could have done some really weird traps or gadgets. I mean, you had George Clooney with a jackhammer.
Oh man, that's
that
such
had a stake
cool thing.
In it. But like that kind of came up once. And you're like, oh, that's sweet. And that was probably as much as it needed to. But then you just had like condoms filled with
holy water. Yeah,
which kind of an interesting, funny thing there. But I felt like they could have
you know, somehow found something.
Yeah, definitely.
More exciting, with how over the top everything else was up to that point.
Super Soaker with Holy Water, the crossbow, and the I like the carving the crosses into the bullets.
Oh yeah,
I thought that was a really cool touch.
Uh huh.
And then of course the makeshift crucifix, baseball bat shotgun.
Right, that he would cock after
with one hand, like
yeah.
That like oh man, like that's so impressive, like cause it. It's doable. It's just very goddamn hard. Like,
yeah.
You have to find, like, the perfect center of balance for it. Otherwise, all you're going to do is just slide the bat up when you go to pump it.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a really cool touch as well.
And then when he jammed the shotgun through...
Through Fred Williamson's character.
And then couldn't get it out and shot the vampires and used his body to cock.
Oh, that was so great.
That was really nice.
One of the other things I love... did you understand the Peter Cushing reference that was made?
I don't think so.
Okay, it was... well, it's when they're talking about, like, what they can do. And they're like, oh, we need crosses. And they're like, yeah, you can just put, like, two sticks together. Thomas Vini has that line. Yeah, Peter Cushing does that all the time. Peter Cushing played Van Helsing in a shitload of Hammer horror films.
Oh, okay.
Usually the ones that Christopher Lee with Dracula... most people would recognize Peter Cushing as Grand Moff Tarkin from Star Wars A New Hope. But yeah, I never caught that when I was a kid, and it's one that I didn't pick up until later. It was like, oh, Tarantino, you snuck it in there. And it's like, there's your reference to some pop culture thing.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really cool. I also, something that just occurred to me watching this one, I don't think Tarantino has either written or made a single movie where nobody watches either television or a movie. And I think that's really interesting.
What do you mean?
In the very beginning of this, Tarantino even sits down in the bed to watch cartoons, and then even in the store at the very beginning, like somebody is watching TV, and then we see that TV report later. But in every single one of them, somebody is watching something,
right?
Which I think is maybe him trying to say something about just like. Film and television, like as far as its impact and influence on culture, and even something like *Inglourious Bastards*, the majority of that plot is contingent upon a movie theater.
Yeah.
So I think I don't know if maybe that's like an unintentional, like this is how important film is to us. Like, I don't know. It's just something that I noticed and I thought it was a very interesting choice.
What were the other uses of that? Another.
I'm trying to think. I think Django may be the one exception.
Okay.
Reservoir Dogs, they don't do... I can't think of when they're watching TV off the top of my head, but they the radio plays into it.
Right.
Though, because that's part of it. Pulp Fiction, Bruce Willis wakes up in the hotel room and his girlfriend Fabian is watching a war movie. Jackie Brown, Samuel L. Jackson is watching this video of chicks with guns.
Yeah.
And then the Kill Bills, both of them. At one point, I can't remember what it was in the first one, but in the second one, like, she climbs into bed with her daughter and watches Shogun Assassin, and then cartoons at the end, and then Death Proof I'm blanking on. But they talk about Vanishing Point a lot in Death Proof, so I think it's very interesting that specifically TV and movies comes up in so many, almost all of his movies, where, like, somebody, like, actively participating in it, not, like, just his background.
Right. But then, how does what they're watching
that beyond that, I don't know. Like, I just had this thought when we were watching it. So it's just something I'd never noticed before, and it just struck me as interesting that he's made that choice to just have people watching something be, like, a part of a scene.
Do you think that lends itself to humanizing...
I think
that are going to be doing awful things later?
I think that could very much be part of it. And part of it, too, is, like, just in general, like, his movies on the whole also, like, show just how pop culture in general, like, impacts or how it's important to characters, like, in these universes, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, to some extent, like, these characters have conversations that, while better written than the conversations we have in real life, are very much in the vein of conversations that people have to talk about these things.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, case in point, like, a lot of the stuff that has been talked about on this podcast is stuff that could essentially be a Tarantino discussion about whatever movie at any given time. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really interesting that that permeates so much of this stuff.
I think, you know, if you create moments where the audience can relate to the characters, it's a very valuable thing, even if it's just as simple as a guy flipping channels and stopping on the cartoons. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What's interesting to think about, though, is, and I haven't seen any of his most recent films, but if you were to do that today, you know, would it be someone is like looks at their phone or they're like playing Candy Crush or something?
Yeah.
Like, you know, instead of I don't know, you'd have like Bruce Willis like playing Candy Crush on his phone while his girlfriend's in bed next to him.
Yeah.
Instead of watching TV, because I mean, television's still around, but it's sort of waning as maybe the popular.
Yeah, but I think like people still watch movies and things
sure.
like that. So I think that's more important than necessarily the medium. So the case in point, like with Bastards,
mm-hmm.
it's adapted to a movie theater because television,
right.
of course, hadn't really been invented and widely
yeah.
Circulated yet.
Right.
So it's I think it's just film and like television in general, like regardless of what format, it's what medium it's transmitted through.
So it's more about the film and video as opposed to just the object of distribution.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think that's just really interesting.
I'll have to take that into consideration. Have you IMDb'd it to look in trivia?
I have not, but I'm sure I will now that I
listeners at home, here's your opportunity. Send us a letter at howhaveyounotseenthis@gmail.com.
Have you not seen this podcast?
Is that really your email?
Yeah,
howhaveyounotseenthispodcast@gmail.com. Howhaveyounotseenthispodcast@gmail.com and let Dustin know what you think about television in Tarantino.
Yeah. Oh, man, I completely fucked this up. I screwed the food. I was supposed to mention this at the top. From Dusk Till Dawn is available on Netflix if anyone hasn't watched it yet. I meant to say, I've been meaning to try and say that at the beginning of the episodes, but I keep forgetting because it's a new thing.
Yeah.
Because it makes sense. Like, oh, how can I watch this without the government coming down because I torrented it or whatever. So
when Christine and I were looking through movies last night, I saw it. And I was like,
yeah.
I kind of want to watch this, but I don't want to ruin Dustin's podcast.
Oh, no, no.
We could watch Kill Bill 2. I haven't seen that one all the way through.
Oh, we already did that.
I saw the part. I saw up to where she got buried alive.
Oh, man. Kill
but
Bill
the thing was,
so
I was
good.
Watching it at Christina's parents' house, and it was on TNT or something.
Oh, no.
So it was like,
no.
It was like she's pounding on the coffin or whatever, and then it's like 20 minutes of commercials.
Yeah.
No. I'm like, I can't sit through any more lifelike commercials.
Those are both on Netflix.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, all the Tarantino films up until Kill Bill 2 are on Netflix right now.
That's
the Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, technically From Dusk Till Dawn, both Kill Bills, and even Four Rooms is on there, which he directed a segment of.
Okay.
So, yeah, those are all on there. I don't know if True Romance is anymore. He wrote that one.
Okay.
But it was directed by Tony Scott.
Well,
so.
I guess I know where I'm going to go for my next movie marathon.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's some good stuff on there from Tarantino. It's everything except his last three, so... Yeah. Cool. I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up here with the favorite moments, so...
Oh, gosh. I think, like I said before, I think my favorite moment was in the opening scene when they go through this whole gun battle. He makes a Molotov cocktail, essentially, out of a roll of toilet
yep.
paper and a shot-up wall of liquor... blows it up and then lectures his brother about trying to keep a low profile while the gas station behind them is exploding.
Yeah.
That was probably one of my favorite moments. Not to say that all went downhill from there, but that was definitely...
But yeah, it definitely opened strong. I would agree with that. That opening scene is my favorite scene in the entire movie. And I think maybe the only other thing that comes close to that for me is... The scene right after they first kill the vampires and George Clooney is kind of talking and being like, alright, so do we all accept that what we're dealing with is fucking vampires? So I don't believe in fucking vampires, but what we just killed were fucking vampires. So everybody knows we're dealing with fucking vampires, right? Any questions? So yeah, that's up there as well. Cool. we'll go ahead and wrap it up there then. Thank you, Matt, for coming on and doing the podcast again.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. I meant to say pleasure.
It's going to be a treasure, too.
It's both. It's a pleasure treasure. thank you, folks, for listening, and we'll catch you next time.